Well, it's time for us to begin. Glad to see so many of you here. As we begin, we are again starting, continuing our study in the book of Numbers. We are, for our purposes, calling it the book of wilderness because that more accurately denotes what this book is about. There is some counting, but that's just not as exciting. We are now in chapter 22, and the Israelites, in verse 1 of chapter 2, it says, "And the sons of Israel journeyed and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan opposite Jericho." And so they pretty much don't leave this area until they go in and take and begin to conquer the land. So they are now poised to go into the land. They are now on this side, on that side of the Jordan, ready to go in. And the rest of the book of Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy will take place here in this spot. You remember we started off the first 10 chapters. We were basically at Sinai, and then they wandered for a while. And then now we're on this side of the 40 years, and they now and we're getting close to the second numbering. But we have a situation that arises. Balak is a king in the area, I'm sure. He is concerned, and we're going to see his concern in chapter 22 and verse, let's look down here at verse 6. Let's begin in verse 5. "So he sent messengers to Balaam," and so basically Balak sees all these people that are coming up around him, and he sends messengers to Balaam, and we're going to see what his concern is here. And he said, "We sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river, in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, 'Behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite of me. Now, therefore, please come, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he who you bless is blessed, and though he whom you curse is cursed.'" And so this is in chapter 22, verses 5 and 6. And Balak is this king, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites in verse 2. And so Moab was in great fear because of the people. And again, I told you earlier that that's how people are reacting to this wandering mass of millions of people. It is, you know, they are ISIS at the time, in the fact that everybody's afraid of what are they going to do? They've been displaced from Egypt, and they're kind of wandering around, and they know that eventually they're going to settle down in a land. And it's not like they can just settle down where nobody is, because everybody has the land. It's all taken up by somebody. And so they have to displace. They're going to displace somebody at some time, and so everybody's kind of worried about what they're going to do. And Balak is among those people. And as we've seen earlier, people have reacted to them in different ways, right? They've tried to attack them, and that was to no avail. And now Balak is going to say, "Well, I'm going to curse them, and then maybe I'll be able to defeat them," here in chapter 22 of Numbers. And so he sends to Balaam. And so he sends to them, and Balaam is an interesting individual. How much do we know? What do we know about Balaam? Yes. We probably know more about his donkey than we know about him, right? But here in this situation, we begin to find out a little bit. We kind of put some pieces together about Balaam. And so in chapter 22, verse 7, the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian, they go out to Balaam. And now Balaam isn't anywhere near Moab. Balaam is up by the Euphrates. That's where he lives. And so they travel some distance to go and get this guy. So he is not just your average Joe. Okay, he's a well-known individual. And the king Balak says, "I know that whom you bless is blessed, and who you curse is cursed." He said, "I know that about you." And so that's why he's sending for Balaam to come down. And so they go out in verse 7, and they depart with fees for divination in their land, in their hand. And so they go out with money to pay this guy to come and curse this other group of people. And so they come to Balaam, and they ask him, they repeat what Balak told him to say. And he said to him, spend the night here, in verse 7, spend the night here, and I will bring word back to you as the Lord may speak to me. All right? And so this is, apparently he's used to receiving this kind of divination at night, and whatever he does to receive that. In verse 9, then God came to Balaam and said, who are these men with you? Balaam said to God, Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent word to me. Behold, there's a people who come out of Egypt, and they cover the surface of the land, and now come, curse them for me. Perhaps I may be able to fight against them and drive them out. And God said to Balaam, do not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. So Balak rose in the morning and said to Balak's leaders, go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you. And the leaders of Moab arose and went back to Balaam, or go back to Balak. So this is the first time, pretty standard, God spoke. Balaam said, you know what, I can't go with you guys, sorry. Just go back and tell them I can't go with you. That was not acceptable to Balak. Balak sends him again in verse 13. We have the second admonition. And he sends, and this is interesting, verse 15, more numerous and more distinguished people than earlier. If somebody sends distinguished people to you to ask you to do something, how does it make you feel? Important, right? More numerous, and he sends more stuff. It's like, hey, I'm kind of an important guy. I'm big stuff, all right? So here is this. So he starts to appeal to Balaam on that side of things, that play psychology with him. And they come and they do the same thing, ask him. And, you know, Balak says, you know what, let me see if there's any new commandment from the Lord my God, okay? I'm gonna ask. And so why don't y'all stay the night here, and I'll ask again. Now, God said no, right? Do you think he's going to change his mind? Probably not. But Balak, you know, is seeing all this stuff, right? And he's like, maybe this time God will let me go. Maybe this time, that seems to be sort of what's happening here in this chapter. And God says in verse 20, God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if men have come to call you, rise up and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you shall you do. So Balaam was happy. Balaam got up that next morning and he went. And he rose in the morning and he saddled his donkey and he went with the leaders of Moab. Balaam got what he wanted. Did God get what he wanted? God did not want him to go. And we're going to see in verse 22, it says, but God was angry because he was going. That seems kind of wrong. God told him to go. God allowed free moral agency in this case. Balaam wanted to go. It was evident that Balaam wanted to go. God allowed free moral agency in this case. Look over in 2 Peter. Second Peter chapter 2, verse 15 and 16. Beginning in verse 15, 2 Peter chapter 2. Forsaking the right way, they have gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he received a rebuke for his own transgression, for a mute donkey speaking with the voice of a man restrained the madness of the prophet. And so he's seeing dollar signs, isn't he? Prestige and dollar signs. He doesn't know the big picture, does he? Probably doesn't know the big picture, what really is happening, that these are God's elect people, all right? But he's just seeing the dollar signs and tunnel focused on that. And so it uses Balaam here as an example of forsaking the right way because of stuff, basically. Jude 11 also makes reference to Balaam. Jude verse 11. Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam. and perished in the rebellion of Korah. And so these are bad examples that are used in the New Testament for our learning. Don't do like these guys are doing. Don't forsake what you know to be right for money. And, you know, Balaam is sort of like a Billy Graham sort of guy in that, and the televangelist kind of people. Heads are coming up now. We're now out of our coma. Okay. Why? Because you can't read the Bible and not know what it says. At some point, you have to decide money and fame or the Bible, because they don't go hand in hand. They don't go hand in hand. It's not a popular message. Never has been. Never will be. They don't go hand in hand. And so he's sort of like the televangelist kind of guy of the time. Don't know what kind of hairspray he used or anything, but we do know that he was seeking prestige, okay, in this situation. And he gets rebuked for it. And so he begins to go and travel with these guys. And the path as he goes begins to get more narrow and more narrow, more restrictive. The first time the angel stands in front of the donkey in verse 23, when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand, the donkey turned off the way and went into the field. And so they're in a path, there's a field. The donkey goes off into the field. If you're, you know, how many times have you been riding your donkey and it just goes off into a field? You know, it kind of, yeah, you probably don't ride donkeys very often. But you get, so he's perturbed because the donkey just went out into the field. All right? And he beats the donkey and gets it back on the path. And then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path of the vineyards with a wall on its side. And so we see the path getting narrower, and the donkey pressed herself to the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall, so he struck her again, a third time. This is in verse 25. And then this verse 27, when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. And this is when there was no way to turn. The path got narrower and more narrow and more narrow. She saw the angel of the Lord ready, sword drawn, probably not something that you want to be seeing, and the donkey just laid down. And he begins to beat the donkey again. And then in verse 28, and the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Then Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you have made a mockery of me." And now imagine he's riding a donkey with, you know, the other entourage. And his donkey goes off in the path. His donkey rubs his foot against the wall. His donkey just lays down. And they're all laughing at him, right? It's that machismo thing again. You're laughing at a man and his donkey. And she replies, the donkey said to Balaam, verse 30, "Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you?" And he said, "No. No, you haven't. You're right." What is odd about this situation? A donkey is speaking, and a man is arguing with the donkey as though this is normal. I find that odd. He doesn't like, "Wow, the donkey's talking. Never, how are you doing? You know, how is it to be a donkey?" He's not doing that, you know. He's arguing with the donkey. And the donkey's making more sense. The donkey's doing what's right here, right? The donkey's doing what's right. Balaam is not making sense. As as was mentioned, it was rebuked by a donkey. It's not making more sense. The Lord opened the eyes in verse 31 of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with the sword drawn in his hand, and he bowed all the way to the ground. He was right there beside the donkey. When his eyes were opened, he got on the ground like a donkey. He was right there by the donkey. And the angel begins to say to him, where is it? And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these three times?" Like, I've been watching you. And I'm sure he doesn't feel that smart at that time. "Behold, I've come out as an adversary because your way was contrary to me. But the donkey saw me and turned aside from these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, I would have surely killed you just now and let her live." And Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing in the way against me. Now then, if it is displeasing to you, I will turn back. But the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, go with the men, but you shall speak only the word which I tell you. So Balaam went along with the leaders of Balak. And so it seems that God is impressing upon Balaam the importance of speaking only where God has spoken in this situation. He is angry, perturbed that Balaam went, but he's pressing upon Balaam the fact that you got to say what I tell you to say. You can't just say any old thing. Is that pertinent to us today? Do we need to make sure that we're only speaking where God? Is it that important? It is very much that important. Galatians 1, if we speak any other thing than that which I have spoken, let us be accursed. And so we cannot speak beyond what is written. Yes, sir? I'm sorry? Yes. Yes, yes, and that's a good point. The money persuaded him to go. The money could persuade him to say whatever he wanted to, or they wanted him to say. Yes, ma'am. Yes, and God is using him. And it seems, as you mentioned, he's, in the side note there, being a magician or magical person, it seems that he has a relationship with God. We don't know much about the past story, the back history of Balaam, but it seems that he knows God. It seems that he knows God, and that God is using him. He may be, you know, we know about Melchizedek, who blessed Abraham, who was a king and a priest of God, when he blessed Abraham. And so there were other people that had relationships with God apart from the Israelites. We know Jethro and his family, Moses' father-in-law, had a relationship with God, and they were still under the patriarchal system. They were not set apart like the tribe of Israel. So it is possible and feasible that these guys had relationships with God, knew God, but Balaam is selling out in his obedience to God. He's selling out here. And so God's going to go ahead and use him to frustrate Balak. And so now Balaam in verse 36 gets to Balak, and Balak kind of, you know, gets on to him. You know, I've called you once and I called you twice. Why'd you take so long to get here? He's freaking out. And Balaam told him, behold, in verse 38, so Balaam told Balak, behold, I have come now to you. I am able to speak anything. Am I able to speak anything at all? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I shall speak. And so he impresses upon Balak, dude, I cannot say anything beyond what God has told me. Okay, so he's trying to make that point to Balak. And Balak's kind of, yeah, yeah, yeah. And they go and make their sacrifices. And they make their sacrifices to their gods. Balak does sacrifice oxen and sheep to his gods. And Balaam partook in that sacrifice. He again is selling out in participating with them in those sacrifices. You know, you gotta appease the guy that's paying you, right? It's just common. It's good manners to do those kind of things. So he as we see more and more, he begins to sell out. Chapter 23 begins seeing these oracles, the messages that God gives to Balaam to say. And it's actually rather funny. The more and more that these oracles are spoken, the more and more Balak gets perturbed and just upset about what's going on. And Balaam tries to stay back. Hey, man, I'm just doing what I'm told. Just doing what I'm told, okay? It's rather interesting. So the first oracle is chapter 23, 1 through 12. We were given this. And what happens is, and this happens every single time, four times, they go and make a sacrifice. They build seven altars. And Balaam tells Balak to stand beside your burnt offering in verse 3. And then he goes over to a little place where he might hear the message from God in verse 4. And Balaam tells God, hey, you know, I've given this offering. Here's the offering. And here's what God tells him to say in verse 7. He took up his discourse and said, from Aram Balak has brought me, Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Come curse Jacob for me, and come denounce Israel. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how shall I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? As I see him from the top of the rocks, so they're up on a place where they can see the people. In verse 9, as I see him from the top of the rocks, as I look at him from the hills, behold, a people who dwells apart, and I will not be reckoned among the nation, and will not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob, or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his. So here's what God is saying. And so here's the oracle, the message that God gives to Balaam, to give to Balak. He recounts basically what Balak has asked him to do, denounce him. He said, how can I do that? Denounce whom God has blessed. And then we're giving this kind of reiteration of the innumerability of the sons of Israel. You can't count them. They're just so numerous. And then he has this, behold, a people who dwells apart. Look over in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Deuteronomy chapter 32. And as we'll be getting to this in Deuteronomy, but this is an interesting concept, a people who dwells apart. Deuteronomy 32, 9 through 11. Deuteronomy 32. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment, the atonement of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He guarded him as a pupil of the pupil of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its wing, he spread his wings and caught them and carried them in his pinions or in his wings. And so we see this care. The verbiage here is as though God has taken them out of nothing and made them his people, encircled them, cared for them as a pupil of his eye, as a wing of eagles. And so this is, behold, a people that dwells apart. They dwell apart because God has taken them to be apart. And again, we can see that symmetry with us. We dwell apart. We live separately from the people that are around us. We live according to as God has called us. And then his plea here at the end is interesting. Let me die the death of the upright. Let my end be like his. In the end, I want to be like Israel. In the end, I want to die like them. What does that mean? What are we talking about here? Any ideas?
He wants to be blessed like they are.
Yeah. If you are one that is called apart and you're dwelling with God in this close relationship, I want to die like a righteous man. How many have come to the end of their life and on death's doorstep, they decide to repent and try to make amends with whatever? How many times in the movies have you seen make amends with your maker? You're about to, you know, that phrase. How many times people want to die the death of a righteous man, but they didn't live the way they might have needed to live. Revelation 14, 13. Blessed are the dead that die in the Lord. And that is true. That is very true. You can write out there. We don't have time to go into this. If you want to write out Revelation 14, 13, Isaiah 57, 1 and 2. Isaiah 57, 1 and 2. And Psalm 37, 37. Psalm 37, 37, as far as dying the death of the upright. Now, Balak wasn't happy. I'm not happy in this situation. You were supposed to curse him. In verse 11, he says, what have you done? What have you done to me? He's taking this kind of personally, right? He's taking this kind of personally. What have you done to me that you are blessed these people? And so again, verse 13, he does a second oracle, goes through the same process. And Balak stresses, you know, we have to go up on a hill to where we can see some of them. You're going to see the back side of the people, but, you know, it's as though you have to see them to curse them, according to Balak. And so they're up on a mountain, and they do the same thing. They build seven altars. They stand beside the offering, and then God gives them the message. Arise, O Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent? Has he said, and he will not, will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and he will not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless when he has blessed, and then I cannot revoke it. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord, his God, is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. A shout of a king. Are we foreshadowing something? Are we foreshadowing a shout of a king? What king do we await that would come out of the tribe of Judah? Jesus. A shout of a king. I love this. Throughout the Bible, you can just underline that in red. Here's Christ again. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of a wild ox, for there is no omen against Jacob, nor his any divination against Israel. And the proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Behold, a people rises like a lioness, and as a lion it lifts itself. It will not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Now that's going to perturb Balak just a bit, because he's sort of wanting to do that to them. And the omen is they're going to do that to all their enemies. That's what the oracle is given to them. And the message is you can't say anything bad about these guys. You can't find anything wrong with them. And then we start this process over again. Balak is perturbed. And Balaam says to him, Did I not tell you that whatever the Lord speaks, that I have to say? He tells them that again. We're given a third oracle to go through the same process. We're given that in verse 24. And the oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, which is in reference to his eyes being opened on the path to coming there. The oracle of him who hears the words of the God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down yet having his eyes uncovered. How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens beside the river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water will flow from his buckets, and his seed will be many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt. He is for him like the horns of a wild ox. Again, this concept that God is protecting them. How many of you have tried to, you know, mess around with a wild ox? Anybody? I can't imagine that it would be a good thing to do, right? How many of you have messed around with livestock at all, period, in your life? Okay. Even domesticated bulls will get after you. Been to Yellowstone? Anybody? Okay. As you go into Yellowstone, just talking about a wild ox, we'll chase a wild ox here for a second. You go into Yellowstone, and they give you a card that says, stay away from the bison, the buffalo. Don't go near them. You know why? Because they will kill you. It is not good. But every year, somebody says, oh, let's get a picture. And they get up close to the bison, and the bison does its thing. So, you know, a wild ox is not anything you want to mess with. And God is saying he's the wild ox for them. He's protecting them like a ferocious wild ox. He will devour the nations again and crush the bones into pieces and shatter them as arrows. He couches. He lies down as a lion. And as a lion, he dares arouse him. Blessed is everyone who blesses you, and cursed is everyone who curses you. And so here is the message again. Not making Balak happy, because that's not the message he wants. Quite the opposite. But he's got to give the message that he told him. And Balak says to Balaam, the Lord has held you back from honor. You know, I'm not going to give you anything. And Balaam says to him again, did I not tell you that this is going to happen? In verse 11. And he goes through the discourse again in verse 15. The fourth and last oracle we're given here. He took up his discourse and said, the oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High. And here's what we, you know, here's why I believe that he's talking here initially about Balaam. his eyes being opened, being the one that has the oracle of God and knows the ways of the Lord Most High. That's why I think he's had a relationship with God. Balaam knows about God. He's not somebody that, oh, you know, God's just going to use. Balaam is somebody that should have known better than to do what he's doing. And so who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down, yet having his eyes. In verse 17, I see him, but now I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel. Put out there Genesis 49:10. The scepter shall not part. Genesis 49:10. And shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and tear down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be a possession. Seir, its enemies, also will be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly. One from Jacob shall have dominion, and will destroy the remnant of this from the city. And he looked at Amalek, and took up a discourse, and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but its end shall be destruction. And he looked at the Kenite, and took up its discourse. So we're looking at different peoples, and giving them specific messages. Your dwelling place is enduring, and your nest is set on the cliff. Nevertheless, Cain will be consumed. How long will Asher keep you captive? And this is possibly a reference to Assyrian captivity for this group of people. And then he says, he took up his discourse and said, alas, who can live again except God has ordained it? But ships shall come from the coast of Ketim. I don't know if you have a side reference there in any of your, but this is possibly a reference to Cyprus, or even this word is used in connection with the Greeks also. And so it's talking possibly about future conquests that were going to take these people away. And they shall afflict Asher and will afflict Eber. So they will come, they also will come to destruction. And so it's talking about destruction for different peoples from other nations that are coming. And so Balaam is giving them the message of destruction. And so in verse 25, Balaam arose and departed and returned to his place. And Balak took his football and went and played his way. Okay, so that's, they basically just left. They separated at that point. There's nothing more to say. You know, it's been said. There's nothing really more they can say. However, we do want to look over in Numbers chapter 31. Numbers chapter 31, verse 16. Numbers kind of goes over some history that happened while they were in the wilderness for the second generation. And so it goes over this piece of information again. And it gives us some extra insight into what happened here. Numbers chapter 31, verse 16. Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor, so the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. We're about to read about a situation that took place for 24,000 people died. And according to this passage, it was advised to the king of Moab, to Balak, to do this. He was given advice on how to destroy. So we're not able to curse them, but this is what we're going to do. So at chapter 25, we begin reading what they're going to do in order to tear the people down, the people of God. And so in chapter 25, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. It's an interesting study. If you want to try this on your own, if you have your word search programs or whatever in your tablets or phones or whatever program you use for Bible study, do a search, play the harlot, or played the harlot in the Old Testament, and see how many times God uses this phrase for his people when they have gone off and done other things other than what he told them to do. In Ezra, in Jeremiah, he uses it very, very explicitly, talking about their relationship with other nations. I would not allow your children to read those passages. They're very explicit in and what he's talking about, and the analogy he draws out about is people playing the harlot with other nations. And so he says here, the people played the harlot literally and figuratively in this case, in that they partook in the offerings of the other people, of the peoples round about them. It says in verse 2, "For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods." And here's where we're led to believe that this is the advice that Balaam gave to Balak, or gave to the people. Invite them to your sacrifice. Invite them, have them to be a part of, have them do what I just did. It's basically because Balak, or Balaam, took part in the sacrifices. Balaam sold out to these nations. And so the advice that Balaam gives is, why don't you have them do that? And have them come over and be a part of these sacrifices. And so that's what they did. They invite them to their sacrifices. The people ate and bowed down to their gods. And this is to the cult, the fertility cult of Baal, is what they're, so you can imagine what they're doing. And so Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal Peor." Not a good thing to do, to sell out. It's a serious thing. God had these people. They were his elect, holy people. He only came close, this close, to this group of people. Nobody else. And if you're going to have that kind of relationship with God, you have to do what he says to do. And you have to live according to his commandments. And you have to be holy as I am holy. You can't just go running off doing whatever you want to do. And that's what they did here. And then we're given another more gruesome story. "Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent." So they're weeping and mourning those that have died because of this rebellion. And so this other guy comes through and says, "Oh, excuse me. And he has in hand another woman from the same group of people. Some people just don't have tact, right? This guy had none whatsoever. No regard for the fact that they're mourning. No regard for the fact that he's about to do what they died for. And he's walking in the midst of broad daylight. He has no remorse, no shame for what he's about to do. And so when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation, took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked, and those that died by the plague were 24,000. So the total, in 1 Corinthians 10:8 references this and says 23,000 died that day. 24,000 died in total. And Phinehas checked the anger of the Lord here in this situation. This is what we would call righteous indignation. Some people may say, "Oh no, you didn't." And he went and took that spear and killed him. God was going to do it. And God was going to kill more than just those two. And then God begins to bless what he did. And he says, "Aaron the priest, he has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them." Right out to the side there, Exodus chapter 20, verse 5. Exodus chapter 20, verse 5. And 2 Corinthians 11, 2 and 3. Paul uses that language, jealous, with a godly jealousy in relationship to the Corinthian church. And he says in verse 13, "And it shall be for him that his descendants after him a covenant of a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God, and he made atonement for the sons of Israel." Atonement means at one moment. The relationship's been broken and you got to come back to God. You got to come back to God. How did he make atonement? How did he make atonement in this situation? Was it with a sacrifice? He took out the offending party. Sin requires blood. Sin requires blood. And in this situation, the soul that sinned, it shall die. And they died. They were shish kebab to the ground in this situation. And so they died. And he made atonement. He made atonement. And that is exactly what the priest does. And so God tells them, all right, destroy those people because they were hostile towards you. They were hostile in the way that they were trying to deceive you and ruin you by sending these women in. And so they go back and they destroy them. The name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur. And so that we actually have the name of the offendee that was with them. Chapter 26, we start a second section, the second section of the book of Wilderness. And we'll quickly just go over this in our last few minutes and finish this chapter. But this chapter 26 is the second numbering of the people. This is the next generation that has come out, and all the other people have died prior to this. All the guys that had said, no, we can't take the land, they're part of that generation, they're all gone. And there's special notation in here that some of the numbers are low because, you know, you just lost 24,000 people. And so it takes into account, in several cases, different things that took place. And so it goes through the numbering of all the different tribes, and we receive that numbering, and the total is 601,730 fighting men. We're not given women or children or those who are not in that fighting age bracket. And then we're given here also a part, separate and apart. We're given the Israelites, or the priests, the Levites. We're not numbered with the people, but we're numbered separately. And then in the last part of this chapter, we're told in beginning of verse 63, these are those who are numbered by Moses and Eleazar, the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. But among these, there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron, the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. For the Lord said to them, they shall surely die in the wilderness. And not a man was left to them except Caleb, the son of Jephthah, and Joshua, the son of Nun. And so those were the only ones was left. Moses will shortly die. Aaron has already died. And so this is the second generation, the new generation that has arisen. And again, that whole process in the wilderness was getting Egypt out of the people. And we've seen a little bit. They're starting to change. They're starting to realize that, hey, you need to be kind of doing what God tells you to do in this process. Any questions, thoughts before we close? All right. Excellent. Thank you very much for your time this morning.